If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
A win, a clean sheet, but questions answered. I guess that's up to you to decide. Welcome to this week's edition of the Pinken.com Norwich City podcast in association with Future Radio, brought to you after another Norwich City win, which is rare and nice. We get to do two of these off the back of that. I'm Connor Southall, joined by Samuel Seaman. We've both been at Carrow Road this afternoon. I'm not sure that was a joyful experience, but we'll get into the whys and where nots in a moment. There's only two of us, as you can tell. Our esteemed colleagues, Paddy Davitt, who's off in Portugal, enjoying some well-deserved sunshine over a long weekend. And Adam Harvey, the most cultured man in Norfolk, who has been to Mauritius. But I'm assured that both are going to be back for Watford and on the road for the hard yards. But it is me and Sam for this week's pod. And we've got plenty to discuss, be it Ben Napper's arrival. We got the opportunity to meet him over the international break. We'll talk a little bit about that. We're of course start though with that victory over QPR. Sam, we'll delve into the performance in a moment, but the result, Norwich's first clean sheet in eight games, without delving into the performance, because I know we're both eager to do that. A win, 6 points from six. Easy as that. Corner turn for Norwich City, isn't it? A jest, of course. In terms of result, though, really important for Norwich City and David Wagner. Probably one that eases the pressure rather than answers the questions.
I think David Wagner is probably the happiest man concerning Norwich City at the moment, and that probably tells you about the fact that it was result over performance, really. As he said, we'll get into it. But on the surface, there were some people worrying about relegation trouble two games ago, and I think those fears have probably quite significantly quietened. So in the short term, they needed to get up the table and they needed to probably arrest any significant fears that that Norwich was sliding back towards League One, which would have been obviously absolutely perilous, especially considering the financial situation they were in. So that for me was the priority. Results wise, it's a pretty grim one, but I still don't think they've shown enough to really suggest that they could push for the playoffs, albeit Josh Sargent's return and other related boosts could help them do that. But I think at the moment, on the results sort of short term side of things, you have to look at it as avoiding some of the more perilous areas of the table, and for now that's what they've done with two wins. Theoretically, they should be able to go and make that a little bit better against Watford and Bristol City, who are both in sort of similar mid-table positions. I spoke to David Wagner about that and asked him that going into this game, and he said he was only focused on QPR. But for fans, I'm sure they would have looked at these three games especially and looked at probably three opportunities to go and improve the situation in the short term. I don't think he's won over too many people with today's events and with the result today, and probably when we get into discussing the performance, the reasons behind that will become quite clear. But for results, for the short term, for, as I said, getting out of that position, which probably he could be bashed over the head with, it's very, very big for David Wagner, because it's a lot harder. Admittedly, it's not a great position to be in as Norwich City head coach, but it's definitely easier to criticise somebody by saying you're 17th in the Championship than by saying you're 13th, I think, which is, I don't know whether that's where they are now, but that's certainly where they were at one point when they were winning. So, in that sense, a lot better for David Wagner, but I'm sure this podcast will go swiftly downhill when we discuss the performance.
Well, the giddy of those out there will realise that Norwich sit currently 4 points off the playoffs, which I think says probably more about the Championship than it does about anything else. That feels, I've kind of described it at the moment as believing in fairies, that top 6-1. Anyone who's kind of watched the last 2 months, and I guess maybe I'd even bundle in the last two performances at Cardiff, which barring a 4-minute spell was stodgy, I think at best. And we spoke about that in the last podcast we did, and certainly this one, which we'll delve into now. I think, you know, it's... Because there will be people listening to this, watching this, I'm sure, who will go, Norwich City won, that's good. Why do we need to worry about performances? But I think there is an element of this, and I referenced it in my verdicts, and I think we spoke about it beforehand as well. When you win a game of football as a team, as a one-off, and it can happen. There's chance is a massive thing in football, so you can get a bit of luck. Huang Yizhou can beat an offside trap. Gabriel Sara can play a wonderful piece of pass. That's quality as well as luck, but there can be fortune in it as well. And it could be argued, if you haven't been on that. But what I'm saying is chance plays a massive percentage in how football outcomes are decided. There is only so much that you can control, but one of the elements that you can control is how you play and the way you set up and stylistically, and I guess this probably lends into this performance, because I think we've seen the science, if you want to use that terminology, is that if you can consistently perform on a high level, results follow. I think Middlesbrough maybe are a good example this season in terms of a really poor start of the season, but actually were performing much better than their results. And I think inevitably you get to a stage where results begin to catch up with performances. If you want a Norwich example, I guess probably the best way to say that is the start of the 18-19 title winning campaign, where Norwich won in six, but their performances were much, much better than that. And I think eventually we saw that take place. So that's kind of the premise and the foundations of this discussion that I want to have, really, because I don't want this to make it seem like we're being critical for the sake of being critical. I think there's an element of certainly me, I like to look at performances, maybe even more than results in some cases, but I think you can say, which is where I think we are today in terms of this podcast, and say, result, good result. Winning a football match is always good, irrespective of how you do it, what level. It's irrespective, you know, when you kind of walk out and the players walk out onto the pitch, they go out there to win a game. Fans turn up to see their team win a game. So all of that is very, very good. But then you've got maybe the other layer to that, which is performance. You can have situations where you perform really well, which is why maybe performance, I think, is a better long-term indicator of a team's ability to have success. You can play really well and you can lose. You can play really poorly and you can win. This is where we get into the chance element of it. Today, Sam, I think we saw the latter, didn't we? This was a poor Norwich City performance, but a win. They had one shot on target. QPR had more. I know David Wagner wanted to discuss the clean sheet, 1st and 8, as I mentioned. But of course, I think part of that lends into what is a QPR team who've scored 11 goals and looked pretty poor in those attacking areas. Yeah. Sam Field could have nicked a point. Yeah. But that's how I wanted to frame this discussion, because I know there will be people who are eager to say, well, you know, you're criticising for the sake of being critical. But purely on performance, which isn't how games are won, this wasn't great for Norwich City. Hopefully I've caveated that enough.
No, yeah, I think you've struck the right balance. Of course, we understand how important results are in football, but now especially is a time to look at the performances that Norwich City are putting in. And yeah, at the moment they don't look great. You have to remember, you know, as you said, we'll get into him and his arrival, but looking more at Belhanda's arrival as a context in which to look at the way that they're playing at the moment, performances are important, because he's trying to judge a head coach, he's trying to judge players. You know, you can look at results, but for the long term picture of this football club, performances are an easier assessor and a more accurate assessor, because otherwise the new sporting director, you don't even need a sporting director that's at Colney, that's at Carrow Road. You could just get somebody who's good with numbers and could look at the results and the stats and the table. You know, Belhanda has arrived at Carrow Road and came earlier than expected so that he could watch these things, and that's why performance is so important and why we're, I think, focusing on it, especially at the moment. There seems a lot of chat at the moment about how even the best teams grind out wins, even Manchester City, even Daniel Farke's Norwich side,
And they do. And sorry to jump in, they do, absolutely. And Leeds are a good example. I guess Leicester maybe are a good example. I think they've won games this season and not necessarily performed that well.
Yeah.
Which, whether they can do that over the long term because they've got better players remains to be seen. But the point with those type of victories is if they're littered in a run, let's say you drop that win in the middle of a Daniel Farker, I don't want to keep going back to those type winning campaigns, but it's an apt example, Norwich City example to use. I guess you could use Man City as well.
Yeah.
If you grind out a 1-0 win like that and you have one shot on target at home, and that is kind of
that's one in six or one in
correct,
seven.
Correct. But the other five have been really good, solid performances. Yeah. You can kind of accept that and accept that there's going to be a dip in performance. When it's not the exception, it's kind of the rule. That's when the long-term question
this
comes
is why
into
I'm
it.
Saying we're speaking so much about it and why it's so important and why Norwich fans are really focused on that at the moment, I think, because they're trying to look to a future that's better than where they are now. It's not like this is where Norwich want to be and they need to get the results to sustain where they are. What we as journalists, what fans are doing, what people internally in the club who are trying to improve things are doing, is looking at things and going, okay, they're at this negative place, they want to get towards the top of the table, how can they change the performance to try and do that? Because as you said, you can't control results, it's down to chance. So I think it's important that we focus on that at the moment. But yeah, just to come back to actually focusing on the performance, and it was a pretty poor one defensively. I suppose it was okay. They did only really concede one chance that you'd expect QPR to go and score, and that was in sort of added time. I suppose you could say also that most teams have good chances that they miss in every game, even in that win over Manchester City in 2019, when everybody spoke about, you know, the greatest win of a lifetime sort of thing. There were good chances that, you know, some of the best players in the world missed in that game. So you have to remember that players do miss chances and there is a certain margin of error. So although I think Norwich were on the side of chance in some ways, I'm not sure QPR were really the better side, or I don't think QPR definitely...
I think a draw would have been a fair...
A draw match. Probably would have been fair. But QPR were a poor side, and if Norwich put in this performance against any side, for me, probably in the Championship's top 10, they would have deserved to lose. So you have to bear in mind all those caveats. Also, defensively, we can look at it as a fairly strong performance. And I sort of tried to ask Danny Bart this post-match, and I think maybe it wasn't the simplest question to sort of comprehend, but I didn't feel like it was the type of defensive performance that can happen while you're playing well in an attacking sense. I don't think, had they been committing more players forward and attacking with more ferocity and getting up the pitch quicker, I don't think they could have sustained the same solidity defensively that they had. So this wasn't a team that was performing on one side, was unlucky or struggling on the other, and just managed to scrape through with the one side. For me, this was a setup that you couldn't replicate if you were at your best attack-wise. So I don't think we can look at this one and say, OK, it was 1-0, but if Josh Sargent was in the team, it would have been 3-0. You might want to look at it as, okay, it was 1-0, but if Josh Sargent was in the team and Norwich were attacking more, it might have been 3-2, you know. So I think there are probably a few different elements that mean that couldn't have been replicated. It just felt so stale. There just wasn't really much going on. Obviously, I was on the live blog for this one and it was actually quite hard to try and produce things and to try and tell the story of a game that basically wasn't happening. It was, I think I said on Twitter, or X as it is now, afterwards, that was possibly the most boring game that I've reported on, bearing in mind I started sort of a year and a half ago when they were in the midst of, or maybe just after they got relegated from the Premier League, and things have only really been going downhill from there. For this to be the most boring game in that run probably tells you quite a lot about what it was, but it was just absolute nothingness throughout, and you just wanted to see somebody try and grab hold of it, whether that be a Norwich player, whether that be the system, Wagner making some bolder changes or trying to do something tactically with it. But I suppose they got the goal, the onus wasn't really on them to go and make something happen. Perhaps it was more on QPR to go and do that, but before the goal, it's not like it was coming and coming and coming. That goal, remember, was against the run of play. QPR spent quite a lot of time, although they struggled with chance creation, and you can probably put this down to their attack, as you said, only 11 goals. They struggled for that incisive pass, but before that, they were quite comfortably finding their way to the edge of the Norwich area. Elias Chair was skipping past players and finding himself 30 yards out quite easily. So Norwich weren't exactly impenetrable. It was just the fact that QPR, up against a block of 8 or 9 players, couldn't find a way through. And that probably says more, given the amount of possession they had, about their lack of quality. So I don't think it was the sort of performance that you could go and replicate on. It's not just because it's boring. It's not just that fans probably weren't excited by that football. It's the fact that even if they wanted to go on and use this as a blueprint to go forward and try and win every game 1-0, I don't think this would be an effective way to do it at Championship level, certainly not for a team that wants to be promoted, as David Wagner has continually suggested is the idea. So, yeah, performance-wise, I'm not really convinced. I know you probably got to watch more of it today than you do a lot of the time, which was in many ways probably a bit of a curse. So I don't know what you made of it, but I'm assuming it was pretty much the same, really.
Yeah, pretty much the same. I thought it was two sides who looked quite low on confidence. I think there's an interesting dynamic with QPR because Marty Cifuentes has come in and has tried to basically overhaul what they did under Ainsworth. They had the lowest kind of pass per sequence of any team in the EFL, really. They were very direct, very long ball. They were in your face. They wanted to run harder and be aggressive and all of that. And he, certainly from the last two games that they've shown, it was interesting post-match, he described this performance as the best of his tenure so far in terms of the way that they've played. But I think there's quite clearly some attacking issues in there. But certainly in two-thirds of the pitch, certainly between boxes, I think you could say, I thought QPR were a lot more comfortable in possession than Norwich. Not that they were necessarily incisive with that possession, not necessarily that led to a flurry of chances. I think they probably had enough chances, I would maybe say, maybe not enough quality chances, but Powell flashed a couple of shots across the goal, and Nikai Kai had one across the goal as well. Chair curled a shot into George Long's arms. There was one that was parried in the second half. So they did have chances. Sam Fields was the best that they had. But yeah, I thought particularly in possession it was really stodgy from Norwich. I thought QPR set up pretty well to prevent them from playing out in maybe the way that they would like. That forced them a little bit longer. It made the game quite attritional at points. And yeah, the one moment of quality really was the one that Gabriel Sara produced to Hwang. And I think what we are seeing as a positive is Hwang beginning to develop a bit more of a relationship with those two central midfielders, which has been good to see. And Sara, who again had a couple of moments and a couple of cheap concessions. That's the type of quality that you can produce, a pass with an just enough backspin on it and enough loft on it. Brilliant bit of technique and Hwang. I haven't seen the goal back yet, but in real time it looked to me like Begovic presented him with quite a lot of the goal, but a tidy finish nonetheless. And we'll come back to him a little bit later because it's obviously been interesting time for him. But you're right, and that's the point. You mentioned it there, sustainability. That's the point that I keep coming back to because. And it was interesting. I spoke to David Vart, you spoke to him pre-match, I spoke to him post-match, and he was making a big play of the defensive improvement. And you know, in many ways, I agree with him because the events that we saw at Cardiff and actually of games gone by where opposition were scoring goals at will and they were scoring two, Norwich have conceded 2 goals a game roughly prior to this game. So you're essentially then asking Norwich City to go and score 3 to win any game of football. And you talk about sustainable, that's definitely unsustainable. So there's definitely a need to tighten up and improve what they're doing defensively. The transitional element of their game has been poor. And there were some signs of that today at points, although I don't think QPR were as ruthless as other opponents have been. Blackburn, for example, Sunderland, for example. So there is an argument to suggest that for sustainability purposes and improvement purposes, Norwich City needed to improve that defence. But you're totally right in what you say. I just don't feel that was a defensive performance that was born of real grit and Norwich. They defended their central area well, but QPR didn't flood that area particularly well. I didn't think Lyndon Dykes presented that much of a threat in behind, so they weren't particularly stretched. And so in that regard, it felt quite comfortable for them. And that's why, particularly when you add that to the attacking element, less possession, which, as I've said in my verdict, doesn't necessarily mean much. It doesn't necessarily mean that you haven't had control of the game, but I don't think Norwich did have control of it, really. But that sustainability point is the one that keeps irking at me, and the one that you've mentioned as well. I just, if you replicate this performance over the next three or four games, I don't know how many points Norwich would pick up, if I'm being honest. And that's the fear that I have. They may well do that, but that is the fear that I have. But also, I think the wider point, I guess, to continue this kind of conversation around performances is, and maybe this lends in to a little bit more of kind of style of play and stylistics and how David Wagner is setting the team up at the moment. I feel like there's quite a lot of contradiction. And by contradiction, I mean, in terms of the way that he had success at Norwich City at the start of this season, the way he was setting them up, high octane, high energy, aggressive, go and press teams, dynamic, try and create these situations that are almost like counter-attacks that aren't quite counter-attacks by inviting a team to press. Obviously, there are some teams who haven't been doing that, and so you have to find a different route, fine. But it hasn't been what we have kind of developed, certainly in recent weeks. And I get it, because you're in a run of form, you're a head coach, you're fighting to save your job, fighting to maybe get a result as well. There is an instinct to go back to something that's a little bit more attritional in terms of hunting for results. But this performance is radically different from what Norwich City were doing during that really good run at the start of the season. So that's one contradiction, which, you know, lends into the debate I think we had after Sunderland in terms of when you're a head coach and you kind of veer away from your principles. I keep using Daniel Farke's name, but again, it's a really good comparison in terms of what he did at the start of that Premier League campaign against Leeds. Yeah. You don't really have anywhere to kind of transition into and to gear into, because you become a head coach that kind of lives game to game. That's not a sustainable way in the long term, again, to use that term. And then also, I feel a contradiction between the way that he set the team up, and we've obviously only had a little snippet of Ben Napper in terms of a club interview, but he spoke about control and his wanting a Norwich City team to, in the future, of course, and under his era, to be protagonists, to play attacking football, to be bold. Yeah. That's a contradiction with what we saw today, and probably for certainly the first half at Cardiff, and for what we've seen for a prolonged period of time. So I guess this probably lends into a wider debate around how long these kind of contradictions can exist, and whether David Wagner can let them exist for a long time. Because I'm sure if he was sat next to you, he'd be making the case saying, well, hang on a minute, guys, you know, before this game, we've taken 7 points from 30. We've been on the run of one win in 10. I need to do something to change the result. So there is always a short-termism element to it. But there's also a lot of contradictions. And I guess for him, it's about how long you can let those contradictions exist before they become problematic in terms of that long-term debate again.
Yeah, it is quite a difficult balance for him to strike. I suppose it comes down to the strength of his belief that this type of football is required to get results. Because if he 100% absolutely believes the way to win this game against QPR is sit behind the ball, defend, don't really attack, and he thinks that if they don't play that way, they'll probably lose the game. It's very, very difficult for somebody who's been under significant pressure, knew he was under pressure going into this one, to go, okay, well, you know, principles are important and I want to show that I've got the right principles to be here long term. So I'm just going to admit that we're going to lose this game, but I'm going to try and impress the sporting director. So I understand from that point of view why, if you really do have beliefs that strong, it would be difficult to stray away from them. But equally, he's got to help himself a little bit in that, you know, we can't really beat around the bush. Everybody expects when a new sporting director comes to a club that they employ their own head coach. That's the history of how the role has worked, is that sporting directors want somebody who they can work with and who embodies their ideas. That's exactly what Stuart Webber did when he came in the club. Admittedly, obviously, Alex Neil had already left, but it was very much his job to go and find somebody who will go and replicate the style of football that he thought could take the club forward. And you look at things with Napa, he's said all the things that you've obviously highlighted. He's spoken about this style of football and the fact that he wants to be front foot. You look at the background he's come from, the influences that he's had. It's not just like you look at Arsenal and you say, okay, Mikel Arteta's been the manager for the last few years. This guy's been at Arsenal for a decade or maybe longer than that. And before that was Unai Emery, who also likes a similar sort of attacking football. Before that it was Arsene Wenger, who, like, especially in that era, before sort of Pep Guardiola.
He played at uni under Graham Potter, who's similarly progressive. So there is exactly. Kind of that
it's
record.
Got that whole lineage of managers and influences and people he's worked with who played that style and who he will be influenced by. And then he comes to this club, he speaks about attacking football, and I didn't really expect him to say possession, because we all know that's not really what Wagner stands for. And
it's not always necessarily, you can get control in different ways.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you're right. But all of that is at odds with the way that Wagner is doing things at the moment. You know, all of it is contrasting with how Wagner's setting up. And you just think, with how everyone's looking at this appointment and how everyone's feeling like it might be inevitable, surely Wagner's tempted to do himself some favours.
But is that, again, sorry to jump in, but is that the culture that's been created because of how this change has happened, because of the conversations that's been had around, because of that perception that you spoke about in terms of sporting directors coming in and, you know, everyone viewing that as, oh, well, they're going to make a change. Yeah. And that was the perception when Norwich brought his start date forward. All the fans went, oh, well, he's coming in to sack him then. That clearly hasn't been the case and isn't the case. And he's going to take a bit more time that, as he's right, I think.
Yeah.
But as a head coach, does that create almost like a self-preservation? Because it's such a difficult job to do. It's a short-term job, really. Yeah. We all know that, particularly in modern football. So is there an element now that he's kind of kicked into survival mode almost?
I suppose so, but in a way that just highlights even more why him and Napa might not work especially well. If his survival mode, if his instinct is go and defend for your life and put out the
but what if that gets results?
Well, it's a difficult question. This is the thing, right? This is why it's not an easy one for Wagner. I'm not necessarily criticising him for making this decision. I'm just trying to highlight the two sides of it. And, you know, I spoke obviously about the fact that I understand if he fully believes this is the only way to win this game, it would seem nonsensical to go and do things the other way. So it's almost between a rock and a hard place. So I do feel for him a little bit in that sense. But equally, I don't think this is going to be the way forward for Norwich, to be honest. I don't see them under any head coach playing defensive football for the next 2 or 3 years. I think either Wagner adapts to how Napa wants to do things. It's either that or Norwich are in a splintered situation where different people want different things, and you're back in that sort of pre-sporting director model of a manager who's responsible for signing players and like a chief executive who's responsible for the money. The manager just wants to spend £10 million on Stephen Naismith or whatever, you know, a bit less money, but, you know, let's say for example the manager wants to buy Stephen Naismith because all he's concerned with is his own idea. The chief executive is thinking about spending money on the training ground, and everyone's just got different ideas. The whole reason for this sporting director model, where one person who has experience in the football world sets an idea for a club, is so that things can move in the same direction, so that there can be a clear plan and a clear identity about a football club. That for me was what was so enjoyable about that earlier Farker Weber. I feel a bit bad because we're referencing Farker quite a lot, but that was the last time it was good, right? So that sort of makes sense. One of the most enjoyable elements for me then, when I was a fan, was just knowing the identity of the football club, knowing that it was almost fun in a way to look at clubs doing what Norwich are doing now and going, oh, that's a bit championshipy. Norwich wouldn't do that. Whereas now there's just this splinter, and I want to see one direction from Napa, and I don't think Wagner's current style of play allows for that. To be honest, if Napa is going to aim for this style of play, which we expect, and I think he will personally.
Yeah, it's difficult for Wagner, because unless he's had a communication from Ben, and we don't know that he has or that he hasn't, but unless he's had a communication of Ben Napa, which is no, crack on, do it your way, your principles. If you lose games, so be it, we'll back you. Then I guess it's very difficult for him to go down that route, continue to lose games, and then for him to say, well, you know, I kind of stuck by my beliefs, because that's a very moral way to do it, but it doesn't necessarily keep you in a job. So every head coach is different, and that, I guess, points to the heart of what he's done. And I think there's also a wider point, and just which will kind of be an apt place to end part one and as we move into part two. But you kind of referenced there the One Direction. You weren't talking about Harry Styles and Zayn Malik and all of those characters.
That did come into my head.
You meant in terms of unity. I got that sense today at Carrow Road, and I've had it for a while. And I'm not blaming the fans for it at all, but it's just a really flat atmosphere. And I think there is that element of kind of uncertainty, maybe, about what they are being asked to believe in. Because, again, and you've kind of summed it up nicely there, it kind of feels like you're back to a place where how they feel about their football team is in, and of course there is always an element of this, but is intrinsic to the result on the pitch.
Yeah.
Whereas there's not this grand sense of togetherness or not a community, that's probably a bit deep and profound, but this sense of, right, I've paid my money, I'm going to turn up at Carrow Road, I'm going to watch a Norwich City team that plays like this.
Yeah.
There isn't that consistency maybe of thought that has existed previously. And that, I think, is very difficult for supporters, which probably lends us nicely into to part two. And the next point that I want to raise about age profiles and squad composition and all that fun stuff. So we'll join you in part two in just a moment. You are, of course, listening, watching the Pink and podcast, reflecting on Norwich City's 1-0 victory over QPR, although probably talking a lot more around that and the events and whatnot that happened, given that I think some people could have sat there knitting today and maybe found that a better source of entertainment. It wasn't the best game to watch, but Norwich City did record a crucial win. One point that I did want to raise, Sam, and we were kind of having this conversation a little bit last night, was around the average age of the team. NCFC numbers, as he does, has crunched it. And this is the oldest Norwich City team in terms of average age since the 1980s. It might even be 1980. It was an average age of 29.8 this afternoon, which is a championship high for this season, overtaking Sheffield Wednesday, who had the previous high of 29.6, I think, in a game that they played. Might even have been against Ipswich Town earlier on in the season. Really interesting, and really interesting for a multitude of reasons. And I guess that first and foremost is how that looks on the pitch. And I think we saw a little bit of that today. I thought Norwich looked quite laboured in certainly their attacking efforts and the way they went to attack. It looked a bit one-dimensional at times, beyond maybe the fullbacks pushing on. And Jack Stacey in particular provided a real thrust down the right-hand side. But I think, again, feel like we're doing a lot of project big picture today. But there is, again, an element of that. Because when you are Norwich and you're so reliant on player trading, to have a team with that much, and again, I haven't had an answer yet and haven't looked into it that deeply, but it must be the first time for a while that Norwich have played a game without an academy graduate in their starting 11. Of course, as a counter, Norwich City's bench on average was an age of 21, so there was a real contrast between the starting 11 and the bench. What do you make of that? Because it is so different to what we've seen in years gone by from Norwich City. David Wagner has been quite big on experience. We spoke to Ben Knappel. We know he thinks that the average age of the squad is too high. He wants to bring it down. We spoke before the break at the end of part one about contradictions. This is another one, isn't it, in terms of where the age profile is at the player in this team? Because Norwich City, a team who have lived and are very and have to be very active in terms of player trading, not really viable for them to have a team that is an average age of 30.
There are so many ways you can break this down and make it a nonsensical argument. And I don't see where in the arguments against having a super high age profile as Wagner and Weber have now recruited, where is the argument for it being successful? That what proof is there out there of teams that have purely based on experience, not really with a lot of pace or technicality, gone and got promoted to the Premier League, even in the last sort of 20 years? What evidence is there that having an older squad, having more experience in your squad generally, gives you a higher chance of being successful in the Championship. I think a good squad is a balanced squad. There's never been a squad that's been full of 32-year-olds, and that's just been the best because of experience. It's all just sort of cliches and words without really any sort of backing. And then you move on to the other elements. Obviously, you spoke about the sort of saleability and the financial aspect. We've just seen in recent accounts that Norwich City are £96 million in debt. The main thing missing from their accounts this season and why they lost £27 million, or last season, sorry, and why they lost £27 million was player sales. So they've combated that by signing loads of players who will have little or no resale value. Which of their players that they signed in the summer, realistically, apart from Borja Sainz, could they sell for more than £1 million? Even in a year, if they have a good year, who could they sell for more than £1 million? Even still, and it just seems just absolutely nonsensical. Then you look at Wagner's style of play, which is another reason why it doesn't work. He wants to have high pressing and energy and quick transition. We saw today, and you were highlighting it earlier, to give you credit, you could see in the team when they counter-attacked, it was one of the fullbacks who, I think, were they the two youngest players? Apart from Sarah, yeah, they would have been Sarah, the two they youngest. Were, yeah. And it was one of those two bombing forward, looking up, having no option, turning around and playing it backwards to one of their older teammates. And you look at that and you think, which part of this current philosophy at this football club, even if you look at the splintered elements that have been there before and that Wagner's introduced, Wagner's style of play, the financial situation, the commitment to producing from your academy, which of those pillars is in line with having a really old squad? It's not even like we can just point at it and say, OK, it's the head coach who's responsible for short-term results at odds with a sporting director who is looking at the mid and longer term as well. Wagner's own ideology in terms of how he wants a team to play dictates that you're going to struggle with an especially old team. And it just doesn't... it doesn't make sense to me in any way. I know you asked him earlier after the game about that age profile, so maybe you can shed some more light on it and some more light on why Wagner feels like that is the best thing to do. But it didn't sound like he was particularly focused on it, to be honest. And given he was somebody who in the summer was talking about experience, before the transfer window we were asking him, yeah, what do you want to do? And he spoke about, we need more experience. That's what we want to do. Yeah, I've gone off on a rant.
No. I think it is a fair point. And again, it lends into, and maybe it's a reflection of the game that we haven't spoken that much about it, but it lends in, I think, to a lot of where, and probably lends into a bit of where the fans are as well. This, yeah. And maybe even some of the narrative that's formed around David Wagner. You mentioned kind of the sporting director element, but there's also not really much about him at the moment that is screaming long term, and that's reflected, yeah, in a lot of the teams he's picking because of the age profile of them. The fact that he's kind of wedded himself to this kind of experienced, big, strong, muscly men in the dressing room kind of dynamic to it, which is fine, but it's about balance, right? Yeah. And at the moment, Norwich have 11 players over 30. 7 of those are contracted beyond the end of this season. It's not going to be a quick fix. And I think to contrast this, because there'll be a lot of people asking about the situation that Norwich inherited and Stuart Webber inherited in March 2017. They had 14 players over the age of 30. So it's not radically different. They were slightly worse off. They had slightly more in that department. But it's a really interesting dynamic that they find themselves in. And what that has taught us is that takes quite a while to unpick, yeah, because particularly when you've got players who are on multi-year deals, be it one, be it two, like you said, quite often finding a buyer for those players is extremely difficult because of their
age. Like you think about the Stephen Naismith bonus, etc. It actually, yeah, cost them money in the end with that group as well.
Yeah, exactly. And also, like, the way I look at it and the way I have looked at it, I think I might have said this before, and you're right, there's no data at all that suggests packing your team with loads of, yeah, players who have loads of games in the Championship equates to success, because if they did that, then the teams who came down and the teams vying for promotion, they would have been signing Ashley, yeah, Barnes and Shane Duffy, yeah, and Adam Forshaw and all the rest of them. There's no kind of evidence for that. I think it's just one of those kind of, not myths, but it's one of those things that people say in football, and, yeah, it's kind of like everyone just kind of, oh yeah, that's right, he does. He's played, yeah, loads of games at this level, yeah, therefore he knows it. But often if someone's played a lot of games at a level of football, then quite often that's their level.
Yeah.
So, and of course, it's right to say as well, that doesn't mean that any, as I've seen the point made as well, that any player over 30 is bad. Centre-backs, for example, tend to peak when they're 30. That tends to be their prime years. But by the same token, do you need three centre-backs who are over the age of 30? Probably not. It's about balance. Do you need, in the same way, in a wider point, in terms of squad composition, do you need six wingers? Probably not. That's probably too many, especially when you don't have any recognised defensive midfielders or any recognised central attacking midfielders. So this maybe lends into the bigger task that Ben Knapper's got on his hands. And that probably is where we're at now, because we've spoken about the age of the squad, the composition of the squad. For all of the focus, as it has been in his first 2 weeks in charge, has been about David Wagner and coming to a decision over head coach, and it's a very important one. I think that this point about squad has also been really underplayed. You mentioned the financial situation as well. I think he's going to have to go with a begging bowl essentially to Mark Attanasio when he comes over to the AGM this week to try and get some funds, any funds for January that he can accrue. Otherwise, Norwich will have to sell to buy essentially. Yeah. It's going to be really difficult to kind of change the face and dynamic of this squad into where he wants it to be, which, you know, as we've said already, is one that's significantly younger than what we're seeing at the moment.
Yeah, I feel for him a little bit, because he will automatically be judged on January because sporting directors are judged on recruitment. I actually spoke to him a little bit about it, about the fact that maybe in this country especially, people see sporting director as almost a glorified head of recruitment, and he was quick to point out that wasn't the case, that actually there are a lot of elements. But the perception isn't that that's the case. The perception is that he should be judged on recruitment mainly. You look at Weber, and he's judged a lot on managerial appointments, but mainly people look at the recruitment failings and successes, and they give him those dues or criticism based on how successful those windows were. And he goes into January knowing this is the first real time he can be judged, apart from Wagner, which now seems to have died down a little bit, the desperation for him to go, not because I think people think he's the right man, but because they realise probably it isn't happening in the next 2 weeks. And he looks at it and probably goes, yeah, okay, January is going to be a big opportunity for him. But bearing all that context in mind, is it really going to be that much of an opportunity for him? You outlined the sort of financial parameters there, and unless somebody high up in the club is going to give Ben Knapper a helping hand, it's going to be the same old Norwich in January situation of either having to sell to buy, or probably doing one or two deals around the edges with loans or freeze or something like that. And I feel for him a little bit, because he does feel like somebody who wants to make an impact on the squad. You obviously spoke about trying to get that age profile down, and it's going to be really difficult, especially in January. At least you look at the summer, and he's got a couple of easy wins. Obviously, it's up to him to judge which of those older players he wants to keep in the squad, because I imagine he'll probably still want two or three at least, because, as I said, it's all about balance.
But even then, of that kind of quota that we've listed, it's what, Ben Gibson, Danny Bart and Adam Forshaw. Yeah. You're out of conscience. So you're only losing three then.
Yeah, so he doesn't have enough options really to make it easy for him in the summer, but at least he has some options. Yeah. In January, it's really, really difficult to really do much at all. So I feel for him, actually, quite a lot. It's quite different to the Weber scenario, because Weber came in, yes, he came in technically in the middle of a season, but it was the middle of a season that basically the club had already written off by putting Alan Irvine in charge of temporarily. And then he had the whole of a summer, not just even the start of the transfer window. He had right from April to, you know, September the 1st, whatever, to actually plan that window and execute that window. Whereas Knapper comes in the middle of a season, somehow has to navigate how to make an impact on this team when he's not even the one responsible for results in the short term. And people will be looking at January as his first real test as Norwich City sporting director. And we've seen traditionally how difficult it is for a club of City's size to do things, and the financial situation to do things in that window. So I'm sure he's desperate to make changes. I hope if they don't manage to make a lot of changes, which obviously we'll see, but it will be difficult, that people don't go, oh, Knapper's got the same ideas as Wagner, Knapper's happy with this squad, things aren't going to change. I do get the sense he does want to make a change, and that there is an appetite for that to happen, but you just look at the sort of facilities and the resources he has available to him, And in the short term, there's not really loads he can do, in my view. I'm sure he will give it his best shot, and hopefully we see some slight improvements. But yeah, I'd be shocked if there's any sort of rebuild or overhaul happening in a January.
Yeah, we met him in the first week of the international break. Sadly, there wasn't an opportunity to ask him questions on the record, and hopefully there is an opportunity at some point in the future to do that, because I think actually in the time that we spent from him, he's an incredibly different figure maybe to the one that we saw in that club interview, where someone said to me he looked a bit green, and I think maybe that's the best way to describe it. But it was such a big moment for him in a role that he's been working so hard to, and I was maybe kind of, I don't want to use the word awkward, because I don't think that's fair. I don't think he was awkward in that interview, but I think there was probably an element of realisation on his part that, goodness me, I'm speaking in a, it's a big role, I'm speaking about a lot of stuff, you know, and I was kind of expecting that when he walked into the room, and he was actually a lot more open and a lot more warm, and actually I left feeling he's quite taller, a lot more taller than I was expecting.
Very tall, yeah.
So there you go, there's a big kind of takeaway. But I was really impressed. I think the view that I got is he's someone who's going to be logical and considered, and he's not going to do anything rash, which is why we haven't seen David Wagner dismissed in his opening 2 weeks. And I think we spoke on the last pod about why that wasn't going to be the case anyway, and why it probably wouldn't have been right to be the case anyway. And there's also, you know, as you say, an element of, we're in November, nearly December now. It's very difficult, I think, at this point to hit reset on a season when you're in. It's a lot easier when you're in Stuart Webber's position in March. To do that in November when you've got, oh, goodness me, what, nearly 30 games now ahead of you.
You can survive it, yeah.
Exactly, particularly when you've got season tickets and whatnot to sell as well. It becomes very difficult. So the reality of him doing that was always going to be very, very difficult. One thing I did like, which I did want to mention, is, and this might have been the case under Stuart Webber, but I'm not sure it was ever publicly said, is that he's going to have a real say in terms of the women's team. Flo Allen's going to be reporting into him, which is really good. He's someone who's been at Arsenal. They've had a flourishing women's team for as long as time, really, as long as the game has really picked up in the last decade or so. So that's really good. I was really pleased to hear that as well, and obviously wish him the best of luck. It's a massive role, and you know, I don't envy him and the decisions that he's going to make, and particularly when there's that expectation for fast change. So we'll see what happens in that regard. Let's speak very quickly as well before we get to what's going to be a very, very busy Norwich City week for a multitude of reasons, about Huang Yuzhou, obviously today's goal scorer. We took his goal really well. I thought it was a tireless performance. I know you kind of pointed out that he didn't touch the ball much, but I thought there was a lot of energy and a lot of work rate and a lot of willingness. I thought it was a very clever piece of movement to actually evade the offside trap in the way that he did and create the run that Gabriel Sara, he has to pick it out and pick it out superbly. Yeah. He does, but it's the initial movement and run that he did that. And as I said earlier, really beginning to see a blossoming, not just between him and Sara, but also I think McLean as well. So that was good. But it's been a really difficult time for him, I think that's fair to say. And we're not going to get into the allegations and what they mean. I'm sure people have seen them if they will know what we're referring to in terms of the active case that is going on in South Korea. It's probably not fair for us to discuss that in real depth and certainly not to pass any commentary on it, because that would be, I think, really silly in our position and actually in anyone's position to do that, particularly when it's happening on the other side of the world. So I'd just urge everyone to be very mindful of that. But there is obviously this active situation that is going in terms of him personally and a situation with a young woman in South Korea. He was questioned by the police over the international break, as was reported in Korea as well. It's an ongoing situation. Jürgen Klinsmann was asked about it. It's, I guess, from a Norwich City perspective, and worth mentioning as well, these allegations predate his time at Norwich City, so worth mentioning that, and they are just allegations. Nothing's been kind of proven. For him to perform in that with the backdrop of everything going on, irrespective of all of those elements, what did you make of him today? Ashley Barnes coming back, that striking debate hotting up. It was a good goal, and maybe proof that, and we saw it at Sunderland as well, there's definitely someone in there who's capable of finishing and finishing chance as well.
Yeah, as you say, it's quite difficult for us to pass comment on what's happening off the pitch, but on the pitch, I think he's maybe a better player than a lot of people have given him credit for. I wonder if we're looking at
a
bit of
fitness, adaptation? What do you think that?
I don't think he suits David Wagner's system, to be honest. I think he's a good player who's technically good, works hard, has a lot of legs for somebody of his age, I'd suggest, to be fair.
He's only 31.
Yeah, sounded like David Wagner now, Connor. 31, to be fair, for a striker, is fairly old. And I think he moves better than you might have expected for somebody of his size.
There are 31-year-olds who don't.
And technically, I think he's really good. He's a good finisher. His touch isn't bad. But he's not really going to win too many headers, especially when you consider his size and sort of if you compare him to other strikers of that size. I'm not sure he really offers the same physical, almost intimidating presence that Josh Sargent offers. If you're a defender, pressing wise, I think he's got the willingness to run, but maybe not the intelligence that the likes of Josh Sargent and Ashley Barnes have. I just don't think he really suits Wagner's system. So if there was a scouting process to sign him, which, you know, there must have been at least a limited one, but obviously the Sargent situation forced them into the market fairly late on. I think that injury happened maybe 5 or 6 days before the market drew to a close. But if there was a scouting process, maybe they didn't do enough due diligence as to where they would fit in as a sort of Sargent replacement, you know, especially given, I think, a couple of weeks after that, Wagner basically admitted he was asking his strikers to play exactly the same roles no matter who they were. Obviously, you have to consider the sort of finances that Norwich had available to them at the time as well. So, yeah, I think on that side of things, he maybe wasn't the best signing, but I think he's actually a pretty decent player. You look at his goal-scoring record. I think he scored 28 goals in less than 100 games for Bordeaux in League One, which is obviously a poor French from me, which is obviously a top flight in Europe, one of the best leagues in the world. And he's got a decent goal-scoring record elsewhere. Obviously, he hasn't hit the ground running in England, hasn't been able to get into the Nottingham Forest team ahead of almost a cast of thousands at times, and everybody knows how they've conducted their transfer business. But he has got a decent record. He's got a decent record at international level as well. And I think he's shown signs of why that is. Today, actually, was a really good finish. I thought he'd allowed Begovic to come a bit too close to him, but actually it was perfect timing.
Quite wide, wasn't he?
Yeah, to go and slot right into the corner was a good finish. Really good finish against Sunderland as well, actually, from quite far out to just place that one in the bottom corner. And I think his touch is actually, the touch from this one was actually quite good as well. So I think he's shown that technically he has the capabilities. I wonder if we're in almost a bit of a Ricky van Wolfswinkel and Chris Hughton situation again, in terms of the player being there but not really the applicability to a system. So I think he can do a job. I can see why Wagner puts him in the team. I think if I was Adam Eder for this one, I would have been quite irritated, but then, you know, he's gone and proven himself with a goal, with probably that pass and that finish were the two moments of quality Norwich really produced in the whole game. So, yeah, I think he's probably proven quite a lot of people wrong with that finish. He's probably done enough to stay in the team, which at the present time probably means he'll be right out of here. But, I think he's a better player than a lot of people give him credit for. But I can understand, especially given the lack of involvement. You mentioned that lack of touches. He actually touched the ball 15 times today, which was the least out of anyone on the pitch, or anyone that started the game, sorry. I think I can see why people maybe are frustrated with him and feel like he doesn't make as much of an impact. But overall, strikers don't really make that much of an impact on games anyway. They're defined by moments. And, he produced a really good one that eventually won Norwich the game. So, yeah, I think he's maybe been slightly underrated and probably has earned a little bit more respect today that maybe hasn't come his way, especially given the fact he's been in such a struggling team, which is always difficult for a striker. You know, it's now quite an interesting debate actually up front with Hwang in form, Eder in relatively good form. He's already scored more goals this season than in any other season. Looks like Barnes is basically a shoe-in for Wagner at any time. Obviously been out now for 2 months, he comes back and plays 90 minutes. So, yeah, a bit of a situation hotting up in the striker department, especially with Sargent to come back as well. So I suppose that's a positive it feels quite weird to be searching for positives in this way after a win. But in a performance of quite a lot of negatives, I think his performance was actually quite a positive overall.
Yeah, I would agree. Just a correction, I think those goals were in League Two. But
were they?
I think they were. But I could just see someone pouncing on that in the comments. So for our South Korean viewers, they're in League Two. I'm pretty sure. But still, a very very good goal scoring record. Really really important busy week for Norwich City now. Obviously they head to Watford on Tuesday, Vicarage Road. We will be there. I think that's going to be a really fascinating game for a multitude of reasons. I think we had a long discussion about performances and results.
Fascinating, if not entertaining.
Yeah, I think that's. That's a team right there who's been performing a lot better than actually their results have suggested, and are very difficult to play against. So I wouldn't necessarily say their league position is reflective of them. And then Bristol City are under new management as well, under Liam Manning, Norwich fan Liam Manning. Yeah. So that's going to be really interesting. So let's deal with that first, Sam. Usually we do points tallies, but I don't think I'm going to hold us to that this time. So two-part question, I guess. What do you want to see from Norwich City? What do you think we'll see from Norwich City?
If you want to give points, go for it.
Yeah. I'll give points. I'll give points. I'll leave that for the end.
Okay.
A bit of suspense, keep them hanging on.
Exactly. Leave them wanting more.
Yeah, exactly. what I want is some bold team selections, but in a nice way.
Okay, what constitutes bold for you?
Probably dropping Ashley Barnes. I think that's... That's okay. Bold. I don't think he really impressed me. We haven't really got round to it, but didn't do a lot. Ended up getting praised by his teammates again for the same sort of...
Housery.
Yeah, it's a bit like the experience age point. I'm not sure there really is data there to suggest that...
I'd just rather win games for quality.
Exactly. Any of those... Do any of those characteristics really... Do they justify?
They're nice, aren't they? I think they're nice added extras, but they should never be leaned upon.
But those extra, his antics in the last 2 minutes don't justify his wages, in my view, in terms of...
Yeah, they're not the only reason he's there, is what you're saying.
That's not why he's been brought there, and yet it's the only reason he really gets complimented, which I think is quite strange and probably suggests when he's not played amazingly. But no, to focus on the team selection... A bit of youth. I mean, it's quite... I just think you want balance in the team. And there aren't too many people that I think played badly enough today to actually drop them. But why not give Borja Sainz a chance? You know, Hernandez wasn't especially good today. Fasnacht was pretty absent as well. Why not just give people a chance and try something when it's not working? I suppose Wagner might say it is working, but performance-wise, it doesn't feel like it is. So a bit of boldness in that sense. Bit more possession, just, you know,
a bit more control.
Yeah, control. Yeah. As much as we're not there purely for entertainment, like we might be for people who pay to be there to watch their team. I'm still somebody who's associated with Norwich, who's more entertained watching Norwich pass the ball around than watching QPR or Watford or Bristol City pass the ball around. So I'd like to see a game where Norwich make it about themselves a bit more. Wagner actually talks about that all the time, about focusing on themselves, not focusing too much on the opposition, and make it about their strengths. So I'd like to see a little bit of that as well. And then just overall a bit better performances. It's a bit obvious, but yeah, I don't know. Is there anything you'd add that you would want to see?
Just some coherent thought, I think.
Yeah.
You know, some consistency of thought running through their performances. Yeah. I think, you know, we haven't really seen that. Like, so a really good example is the second half at Cardiff, where, again, lean into a little bit of game state, but that, for me, if you wanted to say there were positive signs, that their approach, their intent was a lot better. Yeah. But then you don't see that intent today really at all in terms of going and chasing a game. Yeah. Why do you have to be behind to do that? You know, why can't you do that from the off? I just like to see that kind of, this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to play. And I think almost now, more than ever, the fact that you come off back-to-back wins, there should be confidence in the group. He should now, for all of those kind of elements that we spoke about earlier, he should now have that foundation to be able to go, right, we've done the hard bit, we've broken the trend, now we build. Yeah. So now I want to see the building. And if that doesn't take place and we still see this kind of multifaceted approach to every single game, that I think would be problematic for me. So that's kind of what I want to see. And then I guess the final point to raise, of course, is that on Thursday night, Norwich City shareholders, before we come to Sam's points predictions,
that he's promised them,
I'll give one now because okay. I have to, really, because there's only two of us, so yeah. I can't hide away from it or squirm out of it. But on Thursday night, shareholders and ourselves, we will be there. We'll be at Norwich City's annual general meeting. Of course, this is the opportunity for shareholders to put their pressing questions to Norwich City's top brass. Mark Attanasio will be there. Ben Napper will be there. I think it's going to be a really interesting evening. It may answer some of the big picture points that we've made throughout this podcast. We'll hopefully have a conversation with somebody to bring to you after that event, excuse me, takes place. So that's going to be really fascinating. So watch out for that on Thursday night. Obviously, that punctuates games at Vicarage Road and then Bristol City, which is on Sunday. Don't forget, like I keep forgetting. And that's
1:30 as well.
That's
which is so strange.
That's a 1:30 kickoff because of something called rugby. Oh, don't know.
What a waste of time. Don't know what that is.
Yeah. But I mean, we're the wrong kind of people, as you can see, to be just discussing rugby. Right, points predictions. Let's close the pod with this. 6 points on offer. How many are Norwich City going to get from these two games, Samuel?
One. How many did you... I went more positive than I could have. I was genuinely considering...
Do you know what? I said... And I mapped this out to you yesterday, so you can back me up on this. I said, and I said this in team news as well, I said Norwich would win 1-0 today, but it would be a scruffy performance that didn't really satisfy anyone.
To be fair, let's just give ourselves credit. Well, so we've done very well with the predictions. We've predicted exactly the sort of occasion.
I think the only bit that I said was wrong was I said Kenny McLean was going to score a deflected goal, but
it was
a good goal. It was a good goal. And then I said, and I felt this, I was thinking about this walking to Carrow Road today, actually, because that's the sad life that I lead. And I was thinking, I think Norwich are going to get beat in both of them.
Yeah, you did say. Fair play.
So I didn't really want to do points and end on a negative element, but I struggled to see them getting a point. I really hope I'm wrong. I think if you can win one of them, I think that would be fantastic. I maybe feel that there's a more chance of doing that against Bristol City than Watford, but...
Yeah, maybe I would agree with that. I think Watford have better players, and it's just weird. I completely blanked that 3-0 out of my head, actually. I went on a Watford fan podcast, as the opposition preview type thing. And I said, oh, Norwich always lose at Vicarage Road. I completely forgot about that 3-0. But apart from that, it does feel like a pretty bleak place for Norwich to go. I remember going there.
I don't know, they've got a great record.
A Saturday last year.
It's always midweek or evening as well.
Always in the evening. Yeah. Always. I can't remember the last time Norwich played at Vicarage Road in the daylight. But yeah, it doesn't feel like an especially exciting place to go. Wasn't that where Isaac Hayden made his...
It was. Let's let's end on a positive. Sam, give me a positive to end on. that's a very long pause. Two wins and two.
Today. Yeah. Sorry, I thought you meant this week.
Just in general.
Yeah, they've nice positive to momentum. End.
Momentum. There we go. Two wins in two. First clean sheet in
Danny
eight.
Bart's all right. There's a positive. Yeah, he's been pretty decent.
Momentum, as the gentleman to my right says. Let's see where Norwich City can go and where they can take this turned form and improved form on from here. Thank you very much for watching, for listening, and we'll see you again next week.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.